Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, and Regulatory Transparency Project, was recorded on Thursday, May 3, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This teleforum will provide an overview of current thinking about deference doctrines in the Supreme Court, the role of deference in the administration and enforcement of the Clean Water Act, and the implications of abandoning judicial deference to agencies for the implementation of the Act. We are fortunate to be joined by Professor Jonathan Adler and Tim Bishop to share their thoughts with us on this topic. My name is Laura Flint, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Jonathan Adler, the inaugural Johann Verhey Memorial Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law, where he teaches courses on environmental, administrative, and constitutional law. He's the author of several books and numerous law review articles on these topics and clerked for D.C. Circuit Judge David Santelli. And Tim Bishop, partner in the Chicago office of Mayor Brown. He has argued six cases before the Supreme Court of the United States, including the Clean Water Act cases, Solid Waste Agency of Northwest Cook County v. United States Army Corps of Engineers, and National Association of Manufacturers v. Department of Defense. He clerked for Second Circuit Judge James Oakes and for Supreme Court Justice William Brennan. After hearing from our speakers, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Jonathan. The floor is yours.
Great. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. What I want to do relatively quickly is say a little bit about the deference doctrines that are at issue and why they are important for the Clean Water Act, and then turn it over to Tim, who's going to talk about how this plays out in the context of certain cases and certain issues. So typically when we're talking about deference doctrines, we're talking about the various doctrines that determine the extent to which federal courts are required to consider, or in some cases truly defer to and accept, agency interpretations of what the law means, whether we're talking about statutes or regulations. These questions are obviously very important because in a lot of contexts, particularly in regulatory contexts, determining what the meaning of the law is, what sorts of conduct is or is not covered, what matters in terms of what can be enforced, what private parties are allowed to do or not allowed to do. In the case of the Clean Water Act, for example, the Clean Water Act as a general matter prohibits, quote, the discharge of any pollutant, end quote, without a permit from a federal agency, typically the Environmental Protection Agency or the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, or a state that's implementing a delegated program. The term discharge of a pollutant is in turn defined to include any addition of any pollutant to navigable waters from any point source. So determining what constitutes a pollutant, what constitutes a navigable water, what constitutes a point source determines what sorts of conduct is covered by the Act and what sorts of conduct is not. Congress has provided definitions for these terms, but while these definitions are helpful and certainly in some cases expansive, they are not wholly determinate, and there is a fair amount of residual ambiguity about how these definitions might apply in particular circumstances. So, for example, the term navigable waters is simply defined in the Clean Water Act as the waters of the United States, and Tim can certainly attest, this has led to a substantial amount of litigation figuring out precisely what constitutes waters of the United States, what types of lands are and are not covered. Similarly, the term point source is defined to include, quote, any discernible, confined, and discrete conveyance, including but not limited to any pipe, ditch, channel, tunnel, conduit, well, discrete fissure, container, rolling stock, concentrated animal feeding operation, landfill leachate collection system, vessel, or other floating craft from which pollutants are or may be discharged. A very broad definition, to be sure, but one that about which there has been some dispute about how it applies and whether it applies to certain sorts of activities, particularly activities that Congress might not have considered to be a part of what they were targeting with the Clean Water Act. In implementing the statute, both EPA and the Army Corps interpret these provisions. They interpret these provisions both in the context of issuing regulations that are designed to operationalize the statute, as well as guidance documents, guidance letters, opinion letters of various sorts, jurisdictional determinations, and the like that interpret these regulations. When EPA and the Army Corps do these actions, that's where the relevant deference doctrines come in, and why the scope and availability of those deference doctrines matters quite a bit in terms of what sorts of activity these agencies regulate and what sorts of defenses that private parties might have if the federal government asserts regulatory jurisdiction. I assume most folks on the call are familiar with the Chevron doctrine, the granddaddy or the largest or most significant of these deference doctrines. I'll say a brief bit about that as spelled out in the case of Chevron versus NRDC, when the court is considering the meaning of a statute that is implemented by a federal regulatory agency, the court has two questions. The first question is the statute clear? If the statute directly answers the question at hand, then the statute controls. There is no need to proceed any further. The question here again is whether or not through the statutory language, Congress has answered the particular question at issue, such as a particular type of land can be regulated as waters, or whether or not a particular nozzle or vehicle could constitute a point source under certain circumstances. If, however, this statute is ambiguous, Chevron tells us that the court is to defer to the agency's interpretation of the statute, provided that the agency's interpretation is permissible. And it's important to recognize that the standard is whether or not the standard or the interpretation is permissible, not is it the best interpretation of the relevant language, not is it the interpretation that the court itself would have adopted, but rather is it a permissible way of construing the relevant statutory text. In practice, what this means is that for those challenging agency interpretations, the best shots usually occur at step one, trying to convince the court that that Congress has already answered the precise question at issue with the relevant statutory language, because if the agency is able to get to step two, courts are typically, not always, but typically relatively quick to find that the agency's interpretation, if not the best one, is certainly a permissible one. Now, in the last 20 years, there have been quite a few cases interpreting and applying Chevron that in some respects have limited Chevron's applicability. Another way of characterizing it, they have helped define Chevron's domain in terms of when it does and does not apply. The most important of these cases is probably a case called Mead. What these cases taken together basically do is establish that the basis for Chevron, the doctrinal underpinning of Chevron, is a theory, perhaps a fiction, but a theory of delegation, and the idea that where a statute is ambiguous or incomplete with regard to a particular question, that Congress has either explicitly or implicitly delegated the authority to resolve that ambiguity to the regulatory agency. And that theory of Chevron, that understanding of what Chevron is about, has some implications. One implication that the court has spelled out in Mead is that as a general rule, for an interpretation to be legally binding, for it to be something that a federal court must defer to, that interpretation must come as the result of or in the form of an agency action that has the force and effect of law, such as a regulation that is promulgated after a notice and comment rulemaking. The idea being is that Congress has delegated this power to the agency, delegated the power to act with the force of law. Congress knows that in the process of promulgating regulations, the agency will necessarily have to engage in some amount of interpretation, and that that authority has been delegated with the authority to promulgate regulations. Another consequence of this, though, is that things that don't have the force of law generally are not eligible for Chevron deference. So guidance documents, interpretive statements, letters sent to regulated entities and the like certainly may be probative of what the agency's opinion is, how the agency understands the statute, but such documents do not qualify for Chevron deference. They may be persuasive to the court, but they are not controlling. Another consequence of the delegation theory of Chevron is that courts have tried to make clear to themselves that the question that is to be answered is one that has in fact been delegated to the agency. And so, for example, there have been some exceptions like where an interpretation implicates a question of major economic or political significance, such as whether an entire industry, say the tobacco industry, is to be regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. The Supreme Court has said that that sort of question is not the sort of question it believes Congress would have delegated to an agency without saying so, and so Chevron does not apply in that context. The court said something similar in King versus Burwell about whether or not tax credits could be available for the purchase of health insurance on exchanges established by the federal government. Another consequence of this delegation theory of Chevron, though it's important and one that is sometimes controversial, is that if the authority to interpret the statute has been delegated to an agency as part of the agency's rulemaking and policymaking authority, a consequence is that agencies have the ability to change their minds, to adopt different interpretations of the statute over time. And the fact that the agency has changed its mind does not in itself sacrifice Chevron deference or make the interpretation ineligible for Chevron deference. Chevron itself involved a case in which the EPA had changed its mind about the interpretation of the Clean Air Act, and certainly in the current administration, we are seeing many examples where agencies like the EPA are changing what they believe to be the best interpretation or the interpretation they are going to adopt of applicable statutes. So that's Chevron. Let me say a tiny bit about Skidmore and Auer and then turn it over to Tim. If Chevron deference is not available, the default deference regime is something called Skidmore deference. I think it's better to refer to it as a Skidmore weight. That formulation is not original to me, but it's just a way of characterizing what's actually going on. Under Skidmore, a court is generally required to give due consideration to an agency's interpretation of a statute to the extent to which that interpretation is persuasive. And the court is supposed to consider the agency's expertise, the consistency of the agency's interpretation over time, the amount of technical or other knowledge that may have informed the agency's interpretation, and the court is supposed to consider that. The court is not controlled by this interpretation. That's why I think thinking about Skidmore more in terms of weight as opposed to deference is helpful, but the court must consider it. The court can't simply consider it altogether. And things like whether or not an agency has changed its mind over time, whether or not an interpretation is a longstanding one, perhaps one that was developed when an agency is first implementing a statute as opposed to something developed in the course of litigation later on, are things that are appropriate for courts to consider in determining how much weight to give an agency interpretation under Skidmore. Lastly, let me say a tiny bit about Auer and Seminole Rock, perhaps the most controversial of the deference doctrines. Named after Auer versus Robbins, is the modern version of something called Seminole Rock deference, which concerns what to do when an agency is not interpreting a statute, but when an agency is interpreting its own regulation. Under Auer versus Robbins, if an agency's own regulation is ambiguous, the agency's subsequent interpretation of that regulation is entitled to controlling weight, provided that it is consistent with the text of the underlying regulation. Unlike with Chevron, under existing doctrine, the form that the interpretation takes does not matter. It can be a guidance document. It can be an opinion letter. In Auer versus Robbins itself, it was actually an amicus brief submitted to the court that the Supreme Court deferred to. There have been some cases limiting the application of Auer in cases where the regulation merely parrots the language of the statute or appears to be particularly opportunistic or not well considered or non authoritative interpretation of the regulation. But as a general matter, Auer has broader application than and has not been limited the way that Chevron does. Of these doctrines, Auer is the most controversial. Justice Scalia, who wrote Auer versus Robbins, expressed severe concerns and second thoughts about that in the last few years before he died. Justice Thomas has also expressed strong concerns about Auer deference, and there certainly are hints that Justices Gorsuch, Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Alito share at least some misgivings about our Seminole Rock deference. It's also worth noting that we have seen opinions in recent years, both by then Judge Gorsuch on when he was on the Tenth Circuit, as well as opinions by Chief Justice Roberts in the last few years, that suggest that there is not necessarily a willingness to overturn Chevron, certainly a willingness to rethink the scope and application of Chevron, perhaps to narrow Chevron's domain. I think I've gone a minute or two over what I intended. I will turn that over to Tim.
Thanks, Jonathan. That's a great summary. So, as a practicing lawyer, I'm sort of less interested in these doctrines for purely sort of doctrinal reasons. I'm interested in how we use them to win cases, and that can mean arguing for our in some cases and against our in others. Just the way it, the way it can break down in a particular case where you you need to get a result for a client. But, in general, my clients are interested in two things. They're interested in participating in the process that gives rise to rules that they have to follow, and they're interested in getting adequate notice of what rules govern their conduct. There's always a sense that we are better off arguing the statute than deference principles. What we really want is for Congress to have spoken clearly enough that we can understand what that means, follow the statutory guidance as we plan for business down the road, in general, particularly in the big environmental statutes, Congress really does not come back to those and amend them very often. It's hard to do, and so with a statutory interpretation, you get a fair amount of certainty for the future, and statutory interpretation doesn't just depend on text, but on things like context and structure, constitutional avoidance, which was an important factor when the court decided the Swank case, striking down the migratory bird rule, where principles of federalism and the principle that the court wouldn't interpret the Clean Water Act to create potential Commerce Clause problems, led it to a clear meaning of the statute that excluded the migratory bird rule. Maybe, too, some legislative history, seeing a few more citations to that in the court in the post-Scalia era. But number one, we argue for a plain statutory meaning that is binding on the agencies. One of my complaints about deference doctrines and about the current sort of state of challenge to deference doctrines is that they tend to take the focus off plain statutory language. Everyone is so intent at the moment on having the court revisit Chevron that I have a case there at the moment which I think is governed by the plain statutory language of the Endangered Species Act, but I've got a bunch of amici who are saying, let's use this case to revisit Chevron. If the statute controls, then we have nice, plain rules, and we'll argue hard for that. The water transfer issue, for example, when you move water from one water body to another, there's now a rule that says that provided there's no intervening use, that you don't need a Section 402 Clean Water Act permit for that transfer. The Second Circuit decided that 2-1, that rule is entitled to deference, and cert was denied. Throughout the water transfer saga, which has gone on for more than a decade now, up and down to the Supreme Court, We've argued vigorously that you don't need to get to deference, that the word addition in the statute, that you need a Section 402 permit for an addition of a pollutant from a point source to a navigable water, that as a matter of plain statutory language, no addition of a pollutant to the waters of the United States is involved when you simply move water within the waters of the United States from one water body to another or within a water body. That, obviously, if we had ever prevailed on that, would give us considerable certainty for the future. The problem with a rule to which deference is afforded from the point of view of a business trying to plan its future conduct, its projects, is that the agency can change its mind. And as Jonathan said, under Chevron, is permitted to change its mind, provided that it explains why it's doing that in a satisfactory way. There are disadvantages, I think, from the point of view of the regulated community in moving too quickly from what the statute means, sometimes called Chevron step one, although I don't like that. I don't think it's got anything to do with Chevron. It's just the, basically, Marbury and Madison, and this is a statute, and this is what it means. But sometimes, you have to play on the deference field because Congress has not been clear. And Jonathan sort of explained the doctrinal basis for Chevron and lack of basis for our. The water transfer rule is one example of Chevron being applied. Let me switch from Chevron to our. The Chevron principle is we'll defer to agencies when they reasonably interpret ambiguous statutory language, which, as Jonathan said, rests on a delegation principle that Congress has delegated that authority to the agency. The our deference principle is that the court will defer to an agency interpretation of its own regulations. As a doctrinal matter, I think that's very suspect. I think there's very broad agreement that that's very suspect. I think there's considerable expectation, even though it's denied cert a few times, that the court will eventually get to our and will do something about it. But from my client's perspective, the principal problem with our is one of notice and the sort of regime that it establishes that enables the agencies to empower themselves at our expense. What our encourages agencies to do, I think, is to promulgate fairly vague regulations, knowing that they can come back to them later, either in enforcement proceedings or in giving informal guidance or even in just writing an amicus brief to the courts. When they then take a position on what the regulation means. As a practical matter, that's very problematic for a business that has to think a decade in the future on how to conduct itself and what expenditures it's going to make on what projects. So the lack of notice is one big problem with our deference, and the other is the other thing we really care about, which is participation. At least with a rule promulgated with notice and comment, you know, we have an opportunity to make our views known to the agency, and if the agency wants the regulation to survive review, it has an obligation to consider those views and explain why it is or is not accepting them. So there's participation in the process and notice at the end of it. A very stark contrast to our deference, where the agency can promulgate a regulation that has lacuna in it, and then issue guidance or some other more informal interpretation in which we don't get to participate, and in which we've been denied notice, perhaps until it is too late to regulate our conduct. But on the other hand, sometimes we win under our. So even though we don't like the doctrine, and in one Clean Water Act case in particular that I'm thinking of, is the Forest Roads case, DECA, from 2013, which I argued in the court, where the issue was whether forestry companies, loggers, needed Section 402 discharge permits for channeled runoff from forest roads. Basically, when it rains, the water runs down the hills or the mountains and crosses the roads, and some of it ends up in streams. And the environmental groups had sued and persuaded the Ninth Circuit that was an addition of a pollutant from a point source that needed a Section 402 permit. The statute in that case, Section 1342 of the Clean Water Act, it says that you do need a permit for stormwater discharges if they are associated with industrial activity. So you have a general exemption for stormwater, but an exemption from the exemption for discharges associated with industrial activity. The court pointed out in DECA that the terms industrial and industry have a range of meanings. So the agency had promulgated a rule that gave content to the industrial discharge provision by referring to standard industrial classifications. And among those that it listed as being covered were the classification for logging. And so if you look at the regulation and you look at the statute, there's a plausible argument that it's covered that if you have a logging road, you're hauling your cut trees down there, harvested trees down there, and there's a runoff from it, that may be covered. And in fact, Justice Scalia, in his dissent in DECA, reached exactly that conclusion. While rejecting our, he said, read the statute, read the regulation. It's clear that the logging is an industrial activity, and that a discharge on a service road is a covered activity that requires a 402 permit. The court, however, reached the opposite conclusion, giving deference to the long-held litigating position of EPA that only certain narrow activities involved in logging, which did not include hauling cut logs, were covered by the inclusion provision here. And so we prevailed in that case 7-1 on a pure our deference principle. So the case does illustrate that for the regulated community, as long as you'd like the result that has come out of the agency. You can, you can prevail under these doctrines, and they serve some purpose. Having said that, I guess my view is that deference doctrines could easily be replaced by Skidmore principles, which Jonathan also mentioned, which are fairly all-encompassing. I mean, but the particular factors that Skidmore referenced were, you know, the thoroughness that the agency had put into its consideration of the rule, the validity of its reasoning, consistency across time, and in general, the sort of persuasiveness of the agency reasoning. Well, that's pretty all-encompassing and gives the court, I think, a lot of power to second-guess the agencies. But, I mean, you could, I think, substitute that sort of Skidmore principle for Chevron and our deference. In a way, you would be substituting the uncertainty about what courts do for the uncertainty about changing positions in an agency. And that, too, can be problematic because the Supreme Court cannot decide all of these issues when it takes 70 cases a year. And so a lot of cases will be ultimately decided by district courts and courts of appeals, which are not always reliable interpreters of the Clean Water Act or regulatory action. So there's no sort of fail-safe answer to these questions from the point of view of businesses, which I think is why you'll find that, you know, we continue to rely on our and Chevron when it gets the right result, but in general prefer courts to dig into the statutory language and produce a meaning for the statute that is clear and long-lasting. And I think if, you know, a very interesting opinion is the SAS Institute decision from the Supreme Court of a week ago, nothing to do with environmental law, but there's a debate in there about deference. But the majority opinion is one that relies, that does a searching analysis of the statutory language and really never has to get to the deference principle. And I think one reason that it's interesting is that majority opinion was written by Justice Gorsuch. And to my mind, you know, it illustrates exactly what courts should be doing, which is not giving up too easily on the idea that Congress had a firm vision in mind when it passed the statute and used the words that it did, and that often we ought to be looking hard, and if we look hard enough, can actually find a meaning that constrains the agencies. I'll stop there so that we have time for questions.
Professor Adler, is there anything you'd like to respond to?
I'm not happy to go to questions from the audience.
Okay, let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions from the audience, I can ask one of my own. This is a question for Tim. Recognizing that deference can favor regulated parties as well as the government, what are some important examples of applications of either Chevron or our deference under the Clean Water Act where regulated parties would generally support the outcome?
Well, I mean, we definitely support the outcome in the Forest Roads case that I discussed and in the water transfer case. I mean, those are very important rules. And I think, you know, that say you don't need permits for activities that are ubiquitous. And, you know, it's telling, I think, in those. I mean, one thing about AR is that, you know, our deference is undermined if an agency keeps changing its mind without an adequate explanation. At the same time, the grounds for deference are increased if the agency across different administrations has been consistent in its position. And in both Decker and in the water transfer cases, that was the case. And it was the case for a very practical reason, which is that if you have to have 402 permits for runoff from forest roads, as Fish and Wildlife, as the Interior Department pointed out in that case, there are tens of thousands of permits that will be required, including from many on government-owned land. The same with water transfers. Water transfers are ubiquitous, particularly in the West, where the entire water supply depends on them. New York City moves its drinking water down through the Shandaken Tunnel, involves a water transfer that resulted at one point in the city being fined $6 million for not having a permit for that transfer. I mean, the practical problems of requiring transfer in those two particular cases were immense, and I think that persuaded the agencies since the very inception of the Clean Water Act to interpret them in a consistent manner. So when you have something like that, then you have, you know, that gives us considerable certainty, and there are reasons for the reasoning from the agencies is valid, it's consistent, it's persuasive, so, you know, there are good reasons for deference in a situation like that. Now, what I sort of contrast with that, you know, WOTUS, which is, you know, the definition of the waters of the United States that are covered by the Act, the really most basic provision of the Act. But the Obama EPA and Corps in 2015 turned out a rule defining WOTUS that I think was purely driven by politics. It was a truly grasping extension of the power of the agencies over vast swathes of the United States under cover of defining waters of the United States. You know, now the agency is trying to go back and fix that. But I do think that it suggests, what WOTUS, you know, suggests to me is that one of, and this may be a more modern problem, it used to be that you would see sort of evolution of rules over time as the agency learned more and made changes often around the edges. But I think, you know, what we have been seeing more recently is just a very sort of different view, political view of the agencies on what their task is and how broad their reach ought to be, that can produce you know, very different rules. And I think at that point, you know, the Chevron becomes more problematic to apply.
If I could jump in there, I think one thing that's important to remember about Chevron in particular, and whether or not it is seen as a pro-regulatory or anti-regulatory doctrine, is worth remembering that Chevron occurred in the context of the Reagan administration trying to adopt more flexible interpretations of federal environmental laws, the Clean Air Act in particular, so as to reduce the regulatory burden on regulated industries and make it easier to comply with applicable statutes. The Reagan administration had done that. The Natural Resources Defense Council had sued challenging that reform, and the decision was one that said that the administration is allowed to adopt a permissible interpretation of the language that reflects a preference for greater firm flexibility and operational flexibility in the context of regulatory compliance, and overturned a lower court decision that had said that the statute had to be interpreted in line with a broad purposivist understanding of what the Clean Air Act was trying to achieve, and so therefore a more restrictive interpretation of the statute was required. After the Chevron decision, the Reagan and Bush administrations and some Reagan and Bush appointees on the D.C. Circuit in particular deployed Chevron fairly aggressively as a way of disciplining the tendency of some lower courts to adopt these broad purposivist interpretations of statutes to push them in the direction of imposing greater regulatory burdens. And Chevron was used in that respect as very much a deregulatory doctrine. Given the aggressive regulatory efforts of the Obama administration and its use of both Chevron and Auer as tools to defend the adoption of more expansive interpretations of various regulatory statutes, it's understandable why some conservatives view Chevron as something that necessarily has a pro-regulatory valence. But I don't think that's consistent with the history. I think as Tim's pointed out and as the cases he's litigated shows, it really depends on the context. If you have if the EPA is adopting a less expansive interpretation of a statute and is getting sued by the Sierra Club, then Chevron maybe will in that instance have a less regulatory or more pro-business valence. If, on the other hand, the EPA is trying to expand its regulatory authority and is being challenged by the Chamber of Commerce or by some landowner organization, in that context, Chevron will have a more pro-regulatory and anti-business valence. That's really a function of the policy agenda of the agency. I don't think it's inherent in the doctrine itself.
We have two audience members waiting for questions. Let's go to our first question answer.
Hello, this is Bob Davis in Portland, Maine. I'm not an attorney, but I'm very much enjoying your presentation. It seems to me that delegation plus deference plus agency changes in interpretation equals an arbitrariness when stability is needed for the businesses and regular people to plan. What are the limits on delegation? Is it ever used anymore that it's unconstitutionally vague or an unconstitutional delegation of legislative power?
I think that's a very good question. The non-delegation doctrine as a firm limit on Congress's ability to delegate is not something that the court has shown much interest in enforcing in several decades. But I do think it's important to note that concerns about delegation can be seen in the court's Chevron jurisprudence and certainly inform it. That is to say, the court has made clear in cases like Mead and Christensen and Brand X and King versus Burwell and some others that the idea that the agency can adopt a controlling interpretation of a statute is only lawful if the court believes that the agency has been given that power by Congress, because agencies don't have any inherent power of their own, and that recognizing or assuming, I guess, that Congress isn't always explicit about that delegation, the court has to be careful about assuming that broad regulatory authority has been and broad interpretive authority has been delegated implicitly. And that's the basis for the so-called major questions doctrine, where the court has, in a handful of cases, said that the questions the agency was seeking to address and use Chevron for were simply too great and too consequential for the court to merely assume that the agency had been delegated that authority, that for an agency to have that breadth of authority, Congress would have to speak more clearly. So understanding that delegation underpinning of what's occurring in Chevron, I think, is important. Really quickly on predictability, I think predictability is a big problem under Auer and Seminole Rock deference, because here you have an agency promulgating a regulation, and it doesn't have to go through any process to get deference under Auer. Chevron, as it's currently applied, deals with that somewhat, because if an agency wants to get deference for its interpretation, it has to do something like go through a notice and comment rulemaking, which takes time and gives notice. And while the agency is allowed to change its mind, it has to go through that process again to do it. And so you don't have the potential of springing a new interpretation on the regulated industry. In the context of our, because there is as of yet no similar limit on the application of our deference, that is the context in which existing doctrines gives agencies a much greater ability to adopt new interpretations on the fly in ways that could disrupt settled expectations and provide unfair surprise to regulated entities.
And that's a particular problem, you know, under a statute like the Clean Water Act that has criminal as well as very severe civil penalties. You really don't know until potentially too late, after you have incurred, you know, massive potential liability, what the agency is thinking about. I mean, just thinking about the 2015 Clean Water Act, or something that an issue there that's had a fair amount of play recently. You know, that statute, that the regulation purports to exclude from WOTUS puddles, uses the word puddles. And Scott Pruitt has been saying the reg includes puddles, and the environmental groups have been saying, well, this just shows how wrong Pruitt is. He doesn't understand his own regulation. It expressly exempts puddles. The trouble is, who knows what a puddle is? You know, I mean, the agency's view of what is a puddle, and a farmer looking at his field seeing a wet patch could be very, very different. Because if that wet patch is within the 100-year floodplain of a tributary and is recurrent, as most puddles, you know, are, it could well be a water of the United States. So the problem is, you have these terms like puddle that really are very ambiguous. And under the reg, and no one's going to find out what that means until the agency starts implementing the rule.
All right, thank you very much.
Let's go to our next audience question.
Tim and John, Bishop Gruel out in Colorado, couldn't resist calling in with two good friends on the line. The question I had, I was a little curious, you talked a little bit about, instead of overruling Chevron, the possibility about its scope being narrowed. One way I could see that happening is sort of some sort of test to decide whether the question before the agency is more of a technocratic one, whether acting like a special master versus a legal one. But I was curious about what sort of ways you might see Chevron possibly being narrowed in scope.
Sure. I'll start off on that one. Always good to hear from you, Bishop. And a quick plug, I have a very brief article that was in a Chevron symposium put on by the Missouri Law Review a few years ago, called Restoring Chevron's Domain, which details some of this. I think the first and most important way to constrain Chevron is to think more deeply than I think the court has thus far about the implications of a delegation understanding of Chevron, and to engage in a kind of what you might call, some might call, step zero inquiry with greater diligence in terms of what sorts of questions can we assume Congress has delegated to an agency, and what sorts of questions should we not make that assumption about? Again, assuming that Congress has not expressly said, you know, agency gets to decide the following things. And so that not only entails, you know, the major questions doctrine, I think that it should include concerns about constitutional avoidance. So we've seen this in some of the Clean Water Act cases, that if an agency is adopting a regulation that is so expansive that it creates constitutional concerns, say federalism concerns under the Commerce Clause power, that would be a reason for courts not to think that, you know, that courts should not lightly presume that Congress delegated authority to an agency to challenge traditional notions of limits on federal power, for example. That would be the sort of thing where a Chevron could be cordoned off. There have been some lower court opinions where some judges have asked whether or not we need to cordon off application of Chevron where an agency interpretation has criminal implications, as you know, Tim already raised that that's a particular concern, that you can have the meaning of the law under, you know, that violation of which can entail criminal sanctions can change, and can change by an agency doing it, exercising this power. That is something that is of concern. That's something that the courts could do. I think the courts could also think more carefully about the types of questions that truly are Chevron questions. So I think courts are often very sloppy about assuming any time a statute is complicated or hard to parse or really technical, that equates to ambiguity. And that's not the case, that there's a difference between a statute that doesn't clearly and precisely delineate boundaries of particular terms, such as waters of the United States, and statutes that, for example, contain internal conflicts. In the former context, we might expect that it's reasonable to believe that Congress delegated to the EPA and Army Corps of Engineers some amount of authority to determine what lands are bound up into the aquatic ecosystems or the various ecosystems that the Clean Water Act is supposed to protect, and where are hydrological connections sufficient to justify that jurisdiction. Reasonable to believe Congress delegated that, but if you have a statute where there are
did we lose Jonathan Adler? Tim, are you still there?
I'm still on, yeah.
Okay, do you have anything to add? I think he must be calling in right now.
I think I would sort of stress the Jonathan's final point, which is, I think the best constraint on Chevron is to take really seriously the language of the statute and to start with a presumption that Congress was using language carefully. And in the case of the Clean Water Act, for example, did not, you know, start with the supposition that the agencies were going to be able to massively expand their reach into every trickle of water around the country. And I think that Scalia's opinion in Rapanos, you know, really does that. I mean, I think that's the classic example of, you don't have to get to Chevron, because when you take the language seriously and what the words meant at the time, and think about that in sort of the whole statutory context, and bear in mind principles of constitutional avoidance that derive from the fact that the Clean Water Act was supposed to preserve federalist principles, and that you don't want to risk infringing the Commerce Clause. When you bear all of that in mind, there's a clear enough core of meaning there that, you know, supports Scalia's Rapanos interpretation. And I think a large part of the problem with Chevron is that courts, as Jonathan said, I think move far too rapidly to deference and find ambiguity where, if they looked harder, there would be none. If we took the plain language more seriously, that would considerably constrain the need for Chevron analysis.
Do we have Professor Adler back on the line?
I am back. Yeah, I'm not sure what happened there, but I'm not sure exactly where I got cut off. But I certainly agree with those points that Tim was making. I think the only other point I was going to add is that where you have something like a internal conflict in a statute, that doesn't present the sort of question that a Chevron case does. That is to say, there's a difference between Congress not filling in all the gaps and expecting the agency to do that, and Congress merely drafting a bad statute. The former, it's reasonable for courts to say, there's a delegation here, we're going to let the agency resolve those ambiguities. In the latter case, that's not a delegation. That's Congress's screw up. And it's important that courts pay attention to those sorts of difference in addition to simply pay more attention to the actual language that Congress uses. Chevron should not be an excuse for courts to duck their responsibility under the Constitution and under the Administrative Procedure Act to resolve the underlying questions of law.
Thank you both for the answer. Thank you both for the answer. Tim, good luck with your case next term.
Thank you.
Let's go to our next audience question.
Hi, and thank you for a really good conversation. This is Roger Fandelati. I guess we've got Colorado dry winter. We've got a lot of Colorado interest in the water. First, a quick comment that relates to the question I want to follow with. The comment is that there's a sort of a chilling effect argument that if one is going to see whether or not any rule or interpretation or language has a major impact, if it costs a million farmers each something, say, less than $1,000, nobody can afford to litigate it. I wonder if it gets ratcheted up to be considered a major impact. Now, the question, at the extremes of some kind of behavior that affects water, it may be obvious whether or not a permit is required, but there's a huge center where nobody seems to know whether or not there's federal jurisdiction or power to control the action. And so without knowing what the government may kind of arbitrarily claim as to jurisdiction and its power there, isn't the statute kind of ipso facto ambiguous, and then that would tend to push more things towards either Skidmore weight or Chevron deference than really it ought to be?
Well, there are certainly lots of ambiguities in the Clean Water Act. Not as many, I think, as EPA thinks are there, and some courts. I think if the courts really took this seriously, I gave the example of the term addition in the water transfer context, which everyone seems to think is ambiguous, but where I think there's a plausible argument that it answers more questions than the courts have said. And the same with WOTUS and Scalia's Rapanos opinion. It's deeply problematic to my clients, and one of their major complaints about the WOTUS rule. I mean, we begged for a rule for many years in order to provide us with certainty, and then in 2015 we got a rule that not only massively expanded the reach of the statute, but also left a great deal of uncertainty around the edges, both, uncertainty as to what terms mean, like puddle, but also, uncertainty for any regular farmer trying to work out what he's got on his land, because, the agency is prepared to look at historical data that, that isn't necessarily recorded or readily available, and to look at LIDAR and other sophisticated techniques that aren't available to a lot of farmers to determine if you've got some underground stream or tributary on your land that's now dried up, but where there are connections on either side, which is something that the rule treats as a water of the United States. Greater certainty can be achieved, in our view, by cutting back on the extremes of the reach of the regulation. And that's about, the only practical way, I think, to do that. Once you start talking about very remote, intermittent, evanescent waters as being waters of the United States, inevitably there's going to be a great deal of uncertainty. The beauty of the Scalia approach was that you can look at your land and know whether there is a WOTUS on it in most cases.
Well, it looks like we're almost up on our time. Would either of you like to make concluding remarks?
I'm just going to say that, I think you know, we see in environmental context, but not just environmental context, the importance of these sorts of doctrines. You know, we are in an interesting time where both in the academy and on the federal bench, there is a willingness to reconsider the application and operation of some of these doctrines. And as a consequence, this area is a work in progress, and we should not be surprised if some of these doctrines are at the very least modified in the years ahead.
Yeah, and I would only add to that that I think the Jonathan's at the cutting edge in thinking about these issues. But I mean, it seems to me there's room for you know, we're not limited to Skidmore and Chevron and Auer and these doctrines that have already been established. I think that there's room to really rethink these doctrines from scratch, and that we have a court that may be willing to really dig into this area and come up with something more coherent than we currently have.
Our next Telforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Friday, May 4th, and that call will be a Courthouse Steps call on SAS Institute, Inc., the IANCO, which was decided last week, and will feature Mr. Matthew Dowd and Mr. Brian Pandia. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.